Chapter 12. Sis. She knew something was wrong when she went to slide her key into the big Krieg lock on her apartment door, and instead of slipping into the slot with its familiar and reassuring series of clicks, it pushed the door open instead. There was no moment of thinking how stupid she had been, going off to work and leaving her apartment door unlocked behind her. Gee, Miriam, why not just hang a note on the door that says, "Hello, robbers, I keep extra cash in the wok on the top kitchen shelf." There was no moment like that because once you'd been in New York 6 months, maybe even four, you didn't forget. Maybe you only locked up when you were going away on vacation if you lived in the sticks, and maybe you forgot to lock up once in a while when you went to work if you lived in a small city like Fargo, North Dakota, or Ames, Iowa. But after you'd been in the maggoty old Big Apple for a while, you locked up even if you were just taking a cup of sugar to a neighbor down the hall. Forgetting to lock up would be like exhaling a breath and just forgetting to take the next one. The city was full of museums and galleries, but the city was also full of junkies and psychos, and you didn't take chances. Not unless you had been born stupid, and Miriam had not been born that way. A little silly, maybe, but not stupid. So she knew something was wrong, and while the thieves Miriam was sure had broken into her apartment had probably left 3 or 4 hours ago, taking everything there was even a remote chance of hawking, not to mention the $80 or $90 in the wok, and maybe the wok itself, now that she thought of it. After all, was it not a hawkable wok? They could still be in there. It was the assumption you made anyway, just as boys who have received their first real guns are taught before they are taught anything else, to assume the gun is always loaded, that even when you take it out of the box in which it came from the factory, the gun is loaded. She began to step away from the door. She did this almost at once, even before the door had stopped its short inward swing, but it was already too late. A hand came out of the darkness, shooting through the 2-inch gap between door and jamb like a bullet. It clamped over her hand. Her keys dropped to the hall carpet. Miriam Cowley opened her mouth to scream. The big blonde man had been standing just inside the door, waiting patiently for just over 4 hours now, not drinking coffee, not smoking cigarettes. He wanted a cigarette and would have one as soon as this was over, but before, the smell might have alerted her. New Yorkers were like very small animals cowering in the underbrush, senses attuned for danger even when they thought they were having a good time. He had her right wrist in his right hand before she could even think. Now, he put the palm of his left hand against the door, bracing it, and yanked the woman forward just as hard as he could. The door looked like wood, but it was, of course, metal, as were all good apartment doors in the maggoty old Big Apple. The side of her face struck its edge with a thud. Two of her teeth broke off at the gum line and cut her mouth. Her lips, which had tightened, relaxed in shock, and blood spilled over the lower one. Droplets spattered on the door. Her cheekbones snapped like a twig. She sagged, semi-conscious. The blonde man released her. She collapsed to the hall carpet. This had to be very quick. According to New York folklore, no one in the maggoty old Big Apple gave a shit what went down, as long as it didn't go down on them. According to the folklore, a psycho could stab a woman 20 or 40 times outside of a 20-chair barbershop at high noon on 7th Avenue, and no one would say a thing except maybe, "Could you trim it a little higher over the ears?" Or, "I think I'll skip the cologne this time, Joe." The blonde man knew the folklore was false. For small hunted animals, curiosity is a part of the survival package. Protect your own skin, yes, that was the name of the game, but an incurious animal was apt to be a dead animal very soon. Therefore, speed was of the essence. He opened the door, seized Miriam by the hair, and yanked her inside. A bare moment later, he heard the snick of a deadbolt being released down the hall, followed by the click of an opening door. He didn't have to look out to see the face which would now be peering out of another apartment, a little hairless rabbit face, nose almost twitching. "You didn't break it, Miriam, did you?" he asked in a loud voice. He changed to a higher register, not quite falsetto, cupped both hands about 2 inches from his mouth to create a sound baffle, and became the woman.
"I don't think so. Can you help me pick it up?"
Removed his hands, reverted to his normal tone of voice. "Sure, just a sec." He closed the door and looked out through the peephole. It was a fisheye lens giving a distorted, wide-angle view of the corridor. and in it he saw exactly what he had expected to see. A white face peering around the edge of a door on the other side of the hall, peering like a rabbit looking out of its hole. The face retreated. The door shut. It did not slam shut, it simply swung shut. Silly Miriam had dropped something. The man with her, maybe a boyfriend, maybe her ex, was helping her pick it up. Nothing to worry about. All does and baby rabbits, as you were. Miriam was moaning, starting to come to. The blonde man reached into his pocket, brought out the straight razor, and shook it open. The blade gleamed in the dim glow of the only light he'd left on, a table lamp in the living room. Her eyes opened. She looked up at him, seeing his face upside down as he leaned over her. Her mouth was smeared red, as if she had been eating strawberries. He showed her the straight razor. Her eyes, which had been dazed and cloudy, came alert and opened wide. Her wet red mouth opened. "Make a sound, and I'll cut you, sis," he said, and her mouth closed. He wound a hand in her hair again and pulled her into the living room. Her skirt whispered on the polished wood floor. Her butt caught a throw rug and it snowplowed beneath her. She moaned in pain. "Don't do that," he said. "I told you." They were in the living room. It was small but pleasant. Cozy. French impressionist prints on the walls. A framed poster which advertised cats. "Now and forever," it said. Dried flowers. A small sectional sofa, upholstered in some nubby wheat-colored fabric. A bookcase. In the bookcase, he could see both of Beaumont's books on one shelf and all four of Stark's on another. Beaumont's were on a higher shelf. That was wrong, but he had to assume this bitch just didn't know any better. He let go of her hair. "Sit on the couch, sis. That end." He pointed at the end of the couch next to the little end table where the phone and the message recorder sat. "Please," she whispered, making no move to get up. Her mouth and cheek were beginning to swell up now, and the word came out mushy.
"Preesh. Anything. Everything. Money's in the wok.
Money's in the wok.
Sit on the couch. That end." This time he pointed the razor at her face with one hand, while he pointed at the couch with the other. She scrambled onto the couch and cringed as far into the cushions as they would allow, her dark eyes very wide. She swiped at her mouth with her hand and looked unbelievingly at the blood on her palm for a moment before looking back at him.
"What do you want? What do you want?"
It was like listening to someone talk through a mouthful of food. "I want you to make a phone call, sissy. That's all." He picked up the telephone and used the hand holding the straight razor long enough to thumb the announce button on the phone answering machine. Then he held the telephone handset out to her. It was one of the old-fashioned ones that sit in a cradle looking like a slightly melted dumbbell. Much heavier than the handset of a princess phone. He knew it, and saw from the subtle tightening of her body when he gave it to her that she knew it too. An edge of a smile showed on the blonde man's lips. It didn't show any place else, just on his lips. There was no summer in that smile.
"You're thinking you could brain me with that thing, aren't you, sis?"
he asked her.
"Let me tell you something. That's not a happy thought. And you know what happens to people who lose their happy thoughts, don't you?"
When she didn't answer, he said,
"They fall out of the sky. It's true. I saw it in a cartoon once. So you hold that telephone receiver in your lap and concentrate on getting your happy thoughts back."
She stared at him, all eyes. Blood ran slowly down her chin. A drop fell off and landed on the bodice of her dress. "Never get that out, sis," the blonde man thought. "They say you can get it out if you rinse the spot fast in cold water, but it isn't so. They have machines, spectroscopes, gas chromatographs, ultraviolet." Lady Macbeth was right.
"If that bad thought comes back, I'll see it in your eyes, sis. They're such big dark eyes. You wouldn't want one of those big dark eyes running down your cheek, would you?"
She shook her head so fast and hard her hair flew in a storm around her face. And all the time she was shaking her head, Those beautiful dark eyes never left his face, and the blond man felt a stirring along his leg. "Sir, do you have a folding ruler in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?" This time the smile touched his eyes as well as his mouth, and he thought she relaxed just the tiniest bit. "I want you to lean forward and dial Thad Beaumont's number." She only gazed at him, her eyes bright and lustrous with shock. "Beaumont," he said patiently. "The writer. Do it, sis. Time fleets ever onward like the winged feet of Mercury."
"My book," she said.
Her mouth was now too swollen to close comfortably, and it was getting harder to understand her.
"I-ook,"
it sounded like.
"I-ook," he asked. "Is that anything like a sky hook?" "I don't know what you're talking about. Makes sense, sissy."
Carefully, painfully, enunciating.
"My book. Book. My address book. I don't remember his number."
The straight-edged razor slipped through the air toward her. It seemed to make a sound like a human whisper. That was probably just imagination, but both of them heard it, nevertheless. She shrank back even further into the wheat-colored cushions, swollen lips pulling into a grimace. He turned the razor so the blade caught the low, mellow light of the table lamp. He tipped it, let the light run along it like water, then looked at her as if they would both be crazy not to admire such a lovely thing. "Don't shit me, sis." Now there was a soft southern slur to his words. "That's one thing you never want to do, not when you're dealing with a fella like me. Now dial his motherfucking number." She might not have Beaumont's number committed to memory, not all that much business to do there, but she would have Stark's. In the book biz, Stark was your basic moving unit, and it just so happened the phone number was the same for both men. Tears began to spill out of her eyes.
"I don't remember,"
she moaned.
"I don't remember."
The blond man got ready to cut her, not because he was angry with her, but because when you let a lady like this get away with one lie, it always led to another, and then reconsidered. It was, he decided, perfectly possible that she had temporarily lost her grip on such mundane things as telephone numbers, even those of important clients like Beaumont Stark. She was in shock. If he had asked her to dial the number of her own agency, she might well have come up just as blank. But since it was Thad Beaumont and not Rick Cowley they were talking about, he could help. "Okay," he said. "Okay, sis, you're upset. I understand. I don't know if you believe this or not, but I even sympathize. And you're in luck because it just so happens I know the number myself. I know it as well as I know my own, you might say. And do you know what? I'm not even going to make you dial it, partly because I don't want to sit here until hell freezes over waiting for you to get it right, but also because I do sympathize. I'm going to lean over and dial it myself. Do you know what that means?" Miriam Cowley shook her head. Her dark eyes appeared to have eaten up most of her face. "It means I'm going to trust you, but only so far. Only just so far and no further, old girl. Are you listening? Are you getting all this?" Miriam nodded frantically, her hair flying. God, he loved a woman with a lot of hair. "Good, that's good. While I dial the phone, sis, you want to keep your eyes right on this blade. It will help you keep your happy thoughts in good order." He leaned forward and began to pick out the number on the old-fashioned rotary dial. Amplified clicking sounds came from the message recorder beside the phone as he did so. It sounded like a carny wheel of fortune slowing down. Miriam Cowley sat with the phone handset in her lap, looking alternately at the razor and the flat, crude planes of this horrible stranger's face. "Talk to him," the blond man said. "If his wife answers, tell her it's Miriam in New York and you want to talk to her man. I know your mouth is swollen, but make whoever answers know it's you. Put out for me, sis. If you don't want your face to wind up looking like a Picasso portrait, you put out for me just fine." The last two words came out, "just fine."
"What What do I say?
The blonde man smiled. She was a piece of work, all right. Mighty tasty. All that hair. More stirrings from the area below his belt buckle. It was getting lively down there. The phone was ringing. They could both hear it through the answering machine. You'll think of the right thing, sis. There was a click as the phone was picked up. The blonde man waited until he heard Beaumont's voice say hello, and then with the speed of a striking snake he leaned forward and drew the straight razor down Miriam Cowley's left cheek, pulling open a flap of skin there. Blood poured out in a freshet. Miriam shrieked. Hello, Beaumont's voice barked. Hello, who is this? God damn it, is it you? Yes, it's me, all right, you son of a bitch, the blonde man thought. It's me, and you know it's me, don't you? Tell him who you are and what's happening here, he barked at Miriam. Do it! Don't make me tell you twice. Who's that? Beaumont cried. What's going on? Who is this? Miriam shrieked again. Blood splattered on the wheat-colored sofa cushions. There wasn't just a single drop of blood on the bodice of her dress now. It was soaked. Do what I say or I'll cut your fucking head off with this thing.
There's a man here,
she screamed into the telephone. In her pain and terror, she was enunciating clearly again.
There's a bad man here, Thad. There's a bad man here.
Say your name,
he roared at her and sliced the straight razor through the air an inch in front of her eyes. She cringed back, wailing.
Who is this? Who? Miriam,
she shrieked.
Oh, Thad, don't let him cut me again. Don't let the bad man cut me again. Don't.
George Stark swept the straight razor through the kinked telephone cord. The phone machine uttered one angry bark of static and fell silent. It was good. It could have been better. He'd wanted to do her, really wanted to have it off with her. It had been a long time since he'd wanted to have it off with a woman, but he had wanted this one, and he wasn't going to get her. There'd been too much screaming. The rabbits would be poking their heads out of their holes again, scenting the air for the big predator that was padding around somewhere in the jungle just beyond the glow of their pitiful little electric campfires. She was still shrieking. It was clear she had lost all her happy thoughts. So Stark grabbed her by the hair again, bent her head back until she was staring at the ceiling, shrieking at the ceiling, and cut her throat. The room fell silent.
There, sis, he said tenderly.
He folded the straight razor back into its handle and put it into his pocket. Then he reached out his bloody left hand and closed her eyes. The cuff of his shirt was immediately soaked in warm blood because her jugular was still pumping the claret, but the proper thing to do was the proper thing to do. When it was a woman, you closed her eyes. It didn't matter how bad she had been. It didn't matter if she was a junkie whore who had sold her own kids to buy dope. You closed her eyes. And she was only a small part of it. Rick Cowley was a different story. And the man who had written the magazine piece. And the bitch who had taken the pictures, especially that one of the tombstone. A bitch, yes, a right bitch. But he would close her eyes, too. And when they were all taken care of, it would be time to talk to Thad himself. No intermediaries. Mano a mano. Time to make Thad see reason. After he had done all of them, he fully expected Thad to be ready to see reason. If he wasn't, there were ways to make him see it. He was, after all, a man with a wife. A very beautiful wife. A veritable queen of air and darkness. And he had kids. He held his forefinger in the warm jet of Miriam's blood and quickly began to print on the wall. He had to go back twice in order to get enough, but the message was up there in short order, printed above the woman's lolling head. She could have read it upside down if her eyes had been open. And, of course, if she had still been alive. He leaned forward and kissed Miriam's cheek. Good night, sissy, he said, and left the apartment. The man across the hall was looking out his door again. When he saw the tall, blood-smeared blonde man emerge from Miriam's apartment, he slammed the door and locked it. Wise, George Stark thought, striding down the hall toward the elevator. Very fucking wise. Meantime, he had to be moving along. He had no time to linger. there was other business to take care of tonight. Chapter 13. Sheer Panic. 1. For several moments, he never had any idea how long, Thad was in the grip of a panic so utter and complete he was literally unable to function in any way. It was really amazing that he was even able to breathe. Later, he would think that the only time he had ever felt remotely like this was when he was 10, and he and a couple of friends had decided to go swimming in mid-May. This was at least 3 weeks earlier than any of them had ever gone swimming before, but it seemed a fine idea all the same. The day was clear and very hot for May in New Jersey, temperatures in the high 80s. The three of them had walked down to Lake Davis, their satiric name for the little pond a mile from Thad's house in Bergenfield. He was the first out of his clothes and into his bathing suit, hence the first into the water. He simply cannonballed in from the bank, and he still thought he might have come close to dying then. Just how close was not anything he really wanted to know. The air that day might have felt like midsummer, but the water felt like that last day in early winter before ice skims itself over the surface. His nervous system had momentarily short-circuited. His breath had stopped dead in his lungs, his heart had stopped in the very act of beating, and when he broke the surface it was as if he were a car with a dead battery and he needed a jump start, needed it quick, and didn't know how to do it. He remembered how bright the sunlight had been, making 10,000 gold sparks on the blue-black surface of the water. He remembered Harry Black and Randy Wister standing on the bank, Harry pulling his faded gym trunks up and over his generous butt, Randy standing there naked with his bathing suit in one hand and yelling, "How's the water, Thad?" as he came bursting up, and all he had been able to think was, "I'm dying. I'm right here in the sun with my two best friends, and it's after school and I have no homework, and Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House is going to be on the early show tonight, and Mom said I could eat in front of the TV, but I'll never see it because I'm going to be dead." What had been easy, uncomplicated breath only seconds before was a clogged athletic sock in his throat, something he could neither push out nor suck in. His heart lay in his chest like a small, cold stone. Then it had broken. He sucked in a great whooping breath, his body rashed out in a billion goose pimples, and he had answered Randy with the unthinking malicious glee which is the sole province of little boys. "Water's fine. Not too cold. Jump in." It occurred to him only years later that he could have killed one or both of them, just as he had almost killed himself. That was how it was now. He was in exactly the same sort of whole body lock. They had a name for something like this in the army. A clusterfuck. Yes, good name. When it came to terminology, the army was great. He was sitting here in the middle of a great big clusterfuck. He sat on the chair, not in it but on it, leaning forward, the phone still in his hand, staring at the dead eye on the television. He was aware that Liz had come into the doorway. She was asking him first who it was and then what was wrong, and it was like that day at Lake Davis, just like it, his breath a dirty cotton sock in his throat. One that wouldn't go either way, all the lines of communication between brain and heart suddenly down. "We are sorry for this unscheduled stop. Service will be resumed as soon as possible. Or maybe service will never be resumed, but either way, please enjoy your stay in beautiful downtown Ennsville, the place where all rail service terminates." Then it just broke, as it had broken that other time, and he took a gasping breath. His heart took two rapid, random, galloping beats in his chest, and then resumed its regular rhythm, although its pace was still fast, much too fast. That scream. Jesus Christ our Lord, that scream. Liz was running across the room now, and he was aware that she'd snatched the telephone receiver out of his hand only when he saw her shouting, "Hello? And who is this?" into it again and again. Then she heard the hum of the broken connection and put it back down. "Miriam," he managed to say at last as Liz turned to him. It was Miriam, and she was screaming. "Except in books, I've never killed anyone. The sparrows are flying. Down here we call that fool's stuffing. Down here we call it Ennsville. Gonna hook back north, Hoss. You gotta lie me an alibi because I'm gonna hook back north. Gonna cut me some beef." Miriam? Screaming? Miriam Cowley? Thad, what's going on?
It is him, Thad said. I knew it was. I think I knew it almost from the first, and then today, this afternoon, I had another one.
Another what?
Her fingers pressed against the side of her neck, rubbing hard.
Another blackout? Another trance?
Both, he said. The sparrows again, first. I wrote a lot of crazy shit on a piece of paper while I was knocked out. I threw it away, but her name was on the sheet, Liz. Miriam's name was part of what I wrote this time when I was out. And... he stopped. His eyes were widening. Widening.
What? Thad, what is it?
She seized one of his arms, shook it.
What is it?
She has a poster in her living room, he said.
He heard his voice as though it were someone else's,
a voice coming from far away, over an intercom, perhaps.
A poster from a Broadway musical. Cats. I saw it the last time we were there. Cats, now and forever. I wrote that down, too. I wrote it because he was there, and so I was there. Part of me was seeing with his eyes.
He looked at her. He looked at her with his wide, wide eyes.
This is no tumor, Liz. At least not one that's inside of my body. I don't know what you're talking about, Liz nearly screamed.
I've got to call Rick, he muttered. Part of his mind seemed to be lifting off, moving brilliantly and talking to itself in images and crude, bright symbols. It was this way when he wrote sometimes, but it was the first time he could remember ever being this way in real life. Was writing real life? He wondered suddenly. He didn't think it was. More like intermission.
Thad, please!
I've got to warn Rick. He may be in danger.
Thad, you're not making sense!
No, of course he wasn't. And if he stopped to explain, he would appear to be making even less. And while he paused to confide his fears to his wife, probably accomplishing nothing but causing her to wonder how long it took to get the proper committal papers filled out, George Stark could be crossing the 9 city blocks in Manhattan that separated Rick's apartment from his ex-wife's. Sitting in the back of a cab or behind the wheel of a stolen car. Hell, sitting behind the wheel of the Black Toronado from his dream, for all Thad knew. If you were going to go this far down the path to insanity, why not just say fuck it and go all the way? Sitting there, smoking, getting ready to kill Rick as he had Miriam.
Had he killed her? Maybe he had just frightened her, left her sobbing and in shock. Or maybe he had hurt her. Only, on second thought, make that probably.
What had she said? Don't let him cut me again. Don't let the bad man cut me again. And on paper it had said cuts. And hadn't it also said terminate?
Yes, it had. But that had to do with the dream, didn't it? That had to do with Ennsville, the place where any rail service terminates. Didn't it?
He prayed that it did. He had to get her help, at least had to try, and he had to warn Rick. But if he just called Rick, called him out of a clear blue sky and told him to be on his guard, Rick would want to know why. What's wrong, Thad? What's happened? And if he so much as mentioned Miriam's name, Rick would be up and off like a shot to her place, because Rick still cared for her. He still cared a hell of a lot. And then he would be the one to find her, maybe in pieces. Part of Thad's mind tried to shy away from that thought, that image, but the rest of his mind was relentless, forcing him to see what pretty Miriam would look like, chopped up like meat on a butcher's counter. And maybe that was just what Stark was counting on. Stupid Thad sending Rick into a trap. Stupid Thad doing his job for him. But haven't I been doing his job for him all along? Isn't that what the pen name was all about, for Christ's sake? He could feel his mind jamming up again, softly closing itself into a knot like a Charlie horse, into a clusterfuck. And he couldn't afford that. Just now he couldn't afford that at all.
Thad, please, tell me what's going on.
He took a deep breath and grasped her cold arms in his cold hands. It was the same man who killed Homer Gamache and Clausen. He was with Miriam. He was threatening her. I hope that's all he was doing. I don't know. She screamed. The line went dead.
Oh, Thad, Jesus!
There's no time for either of us to have hysterics, he said, and thought, although God knows part of me wants to.
Go upstairs. Get your address book. I don't have Miriam's phone number and address in mind. I think you do. What did you mean you knew it almost from the first? There's no time for that now, Liz. Get your address book. Get it quick, okay? She hesitated a moment longer. She may be hurt. Go! She turned and ran from the room. He heard the quick, light pad of her feet going upstairs and tried to get his thoughts working again. Don't call Rick. If it is a trap, calling Rick would be a very bad idea. Okay, we've gotten that far. It's not much, but it's a start. Who, then? The New York City Police Department? No, they would be full of time-consuming questions. How come a fellow in Maine was reporting a crime in New York, for starters? Not the NYPD. Another very bad idea. Pangborn. His mind seized on the idea. He would call Pangborn first. He would have to be careful what he said, at least for now. What he might or might not decide to say later on. About the blackouts, about the sound of the sparrows, about Stark, could take care of itself. For now, Miriam was the important thing. If Miriam was hurt but still alive, it wouldn't do to inject any elements into the situation which might slow Pangborn down. He was the one who'd have to call the New York cops. They would act faster and ask fewer questions if word came from one of their own, even if this particular brother cop happened to be up in Maine. But Miriam first. Pray God she answered the phone. Liz came flying back into the room with her address book. Her face was almost as pale as it had been after she had finally succeeded in bringing William and Wendy into the world. "Here it is," she said. She was breathing fast, nearly panting. "This is going to be all right," he thought to say to her, but held it back. He didn't want to say anything which could so easily turn out to be a lie, and the sound of Miriam's scream suggested things had gone well past the all right stage, that for Miriam, at least, things might never return to the all right stage.
"There's a man here. There's a bad man here."
Thad thought of George Stark and shuddered a little. He was a very bad man, all right. Thad knew the truth of that better than anyone. He had, after all, built George Stark from the ground up, hadn't he? "We're okay," he said to Liz. That much at least was true. "So far," his mind insisted on adding in a whisper. "Get hold of yourself if you can, babe. Hyperventilating and fainting on the floor won't help Miriam." She sat down, ramrod straight, staring at him while her teeth gnawed relentlessly at her lower lip. He started to punch Miriam's number. His fingers, shaking a little, stuttered on the second digit, hitting it twice. "You're a great one to be telling people to get hold of themselves." He drew in another long breath, held it, hit the disconnect button on the phone, and started in again, forcing himself to slow down. He hit the last button and listened to the deliberate clicks of the connection falling into place. "Let her be all right, God. And if she's not entirely all right, if you can't manage that, at least let her be all right enough to answer the telephone. Please." But the phone didn't ring. There was only the insistent da-da-da of a busy signal. Maybe it really was busy. Maybe she was calling Rick or the hospital. Or maybe the phone was off the hook. There was another possibility, though, he thought as he pushed the disconnect button again. Maybe Stark had pulled the phone cord out of the wall. Or maybe, "Don't let the bad man cut me again." He had cut it, as he had cut Miriam. Razor, Thad thought, and a shudder twisted up his back. That had been another of the words in the stew of them he had written that afternoon. Razor. Two. The next half hour or so was a return to the ominous surrealism he had felt when Pangborn and the two state troopers had turned up on his doorstep to arrest him for a murder he hadn't even known about. There was no sense of personal threat, no immediate personal threat at least, but the same feeling of walking through a dark room filled with delicate strands of cobweb which brushed across your face, first tickling and ultimately maddening, strands which did not stick but whispered away just before you could grab them. He tried Miriam's number again, and when it was still busy, he pushed the disconnect button once more and hesitated for just a moment, torn between calling Pangborn and calling an operator in New York to check Miriam's phone. Didn't they have some means of differentiating among a line where someone was talking, one that was off the hook and one which had been rendered inoperable in some way? He thought they did, But surely the important thing was that Miriam's communication with him had suddenly ceased, and she was no longer reachable. Still, they could find out. Liz could find out, if they had two lines instead of just one. Why didn't they have two lines? It was stupid not to have two lines, wasn't it? Although these thoughts went through his mind in perhaps 2 seconds, they seemed to take much longer, and he berated himself for playing Hamlet while Miriam Cowley might be bleeding to death in her apartment. Characters in books, at least in Stark's books, never took pauses like this, never stopped to wonder something nonsensical like why they had never had a second telephone line put in for cases where a woman in another state might be bleeding to death. People in books never had to take time out so they could move their bowels, and they never clutched up like this. The world would be a more efficient place if everyone in it came out of a pop novel, he thought. People in pop novels always manage to keep their thoughts on track as they move smoothly from one chapter to the next. He dialed main directory assistance, and when the operator asked, "What city, please?" he foundered for a moment, because Castle Rock was a town, not a city, but a small town, county seat or not. And then he thought, "This is panic, Thad. Sheer panic. You've got to get it under control. You mustn't let Miriam die because you panicked." And he even had time, it seemed, to wonder why he couldn't let that happen, and to answer the question. He was the only real character over whom he had any control at all, and panic was simply not a part of that character's image, at least as he saw it. "Down here we call that bullshit, Thad. Down here we call it fools." "Sir?" the operator was prodding. "What city, please?" "Okay, control." He took a deep breath, got his shit together, and said, "Castle City." "Christ." Closed his eyes, and with them still closed, said slowly and clearly, "I'm sorry, operator, Castle Rock. I'd like the number for the sheriff's office." There was a lag, and then a robot voice began to recite the number. Thad realized he had no pen or pencil. The robot repeated it a second time. Thad strove mightily to remember it, and the number zipped right across his mind and into blackness again, not even leaving a faint trace behind. "If you need further assistance," the robot voice was continuing, "please remain on the line, and an operator..." "Liz," he pleaded, "pen? Something to write with?" There was a Bic tucked into her address book, and she handed it to him. The operator, the human operator, came back on the line. Thad told her he hadn't noted the number down. The operator summoned the robot, who recited once again in her jig-jagging, vaguely female voice. Thad jotted the number on the cover of a book, almost hung up, then decided to double-check by listening to the second programmed recital. The second rendition showed he had transposed two of the numbers. Oh, he was getting right on top of his panic, that was crystal clear. He punched the disconnect button. Light sweat had broken out all over his body.
"Take it easy, Thad."
"You didn't hear her," he said grimly, and dialed the sheriff's office. The phone rang 4 times before a bored Yankee voice said, "Castle County Sheriff's Office, Deputy Ridgewick speaking. May I help you?"
"This is Thad Beaumont. I'm calling from Ludlow."
"Oh?" No recognition. None. Which meant more explanations, more cobwebs. The name Ridgewick rang a faint bell. Of course, the officer who had interviewed Mrs. Arsenault and found Gamache's body. Jesus bleeding Christ, how could he have found the old man Thad was supposed to have murdered and not know who he was?
"Sheriff Pangborn came up here to discuss the Homer Gamache murder with me, Deputy Ridgewick. I have some information on that, and it's important that I speak to him right away."
"Sheriff's not here," Ridgewick said, sounding monumentally unimpressed with the urgency in Thad's voice.
"Well, where is he?"
"To home."
"Give me the number, please."
And, unbelievably,
"Oh, I don't know as I should, Mr. Bowman. The sheriff, Alan, I mean, hasn't had much time off just lately, and his wife has been a trifle poorly. She has headaches."
"I have to talk to him."
"Well," Ridgewick said comfortably,
"it's pretty clear you think you do, anyway. Maybe you even do. Really do, I mean.
Tell you what, Mr. Bowman, why don't you just lay it out for me and kind of let me be the judge?
He came up here to arrest me for the murder of Homer Gamache, Deputy, and something else has happened, and if you don't give me his number right now—
Oh, holy crow! Ridgwick cried. Thad heard a faint bang and could imagine Ridgwick's feet coming down off his desk, or more likely Pangborn's desk, and landing on the floor as he straightened up in his seat.
Beaumont, not Bowman.
Yes, and oh, Judas Priest. The sheriff, Alan, said if you was to call, I should see you got through right away.
Good. Now, Judas Priest, I'm a damn lunkhead.
Thad, who could not have agreed more, said, give me his number, please. Somehow, calling upon reserves he'd had no idea he possessed, he managed not to scream it.
Sure, just a sec.
An excruciating pause ensued. Seconds only, of course, but it seemed to Thad that the pyramids could have been built during that pause. Built and then torn down again. And all the while, Miriam's life could be draining out on her living room rug 500 miles away. I may have killed her, he thought, simply by deciding to call Pangborn and getting this congenital idiot instead of calling the New York Police Department in the first place. Or 911. That's what I probably should have done, dialed 911 and thrown it into their laps. Except that option did not seem real, even now. It was the trance, he supposed, and the words he had written while in that trance. He did not think he had foreseen the attack on Miriam, but he had, in some dim way, witnessed Stark's preparations for the attack. The ghostly cries of those thousands of birds seemed to make this whole crazy thing his responsibility. But if Miriam died simply because he had been too panicked to dial 911, how would he ever be able to face Rick again? Fuck that. How would he ever be able to look at himself again in a mirror? Ridgwick, the down-home Yankee idiot, was back. He gave Thad the sheriff's number, speaking each digit slowly enough for a retarded person to have taken the number down, but Thad made him repeat it anyway, in spite of the burning, digging urge to hurry. He was still shaken by how effortlessly he had screwed up the sheriff's office number, and what could be done once could be done again. Okay, he said, thanks.
Mr. Beaumont, sure would appreciate it if you'd kind of soft-pedal any stuff about how I...
Thad hung up on him without the slightest twinge of remorse and dialed the number Ridgwick had given him. Pangborn would not answer the phone, of course. That was simply too much to hope for on the night of the cobwebs, and whoever did answer would tell him, after the obligatory few minutes of verbal ring around the rosy that was, that the sheriff had gone out for a loaf of bread and a gallon of milk. In Laconia, New Hampshire, probably, although Phoenix was not entirely out of the question. He uttered a wild bark of laughter, and Liz looked at him, startled.
Thad, are you all right?
He started to answer, then just flapped a hand at her to show he was as the phone was picked up. It wasn't Pangborn. He'd had that much right anyway. It was a little boy who sounded about 10.
Hello, Pangborn residence, he piped. Todd Pangborn speaking.
Hi, Thad said. He was dimly aware that he was holding the phone receiver much too tightly and tried to loosen his fingers. They creaked but didn't really budge. My name is Thad... Pangborn, he almost finished. Oh, Jesus, that would be good. You're on top of this all right, Thad. You missed your calling. You should have been an air traffic controller. Beaumont, he finished after the brief mid-course correction. Is the sheriff there?
No, he had to go to Lodi, California for beer and cigarettes.
Instead, the boy's voice moved away from the telephone mouthpiece and bugled, Dad! Phone! This was followed by a heavy clunk that made Thad's ear ache. A moment later, oh praise God and all his holy saints, the voice of Alan Pangborn said, Hello? At the sound of that voice, Thad's mental buck fever melted away. It's Thad Beaumont, Sheriff Pangborn. There's a lady in New York that may need help very badly right now. It has to do with the matter we were discussing Saturday night.
Shoot, Alan said crisply. Just that. And the relief, oh boy.
Thad felt like a picture coming back into focus.
The woman is Miriam Cowley, my agent's ex-wife.
Thad reflected that only a minute ago he undoubtedly would have identified Miriam as my ex-wife's agent.
She called here. She was crying, extremely distraught. I didn't even know who she was at first. Then I heard a man's voice in the background. He said for her to tell me who she was and what was going on. She said there was a man in her apartment, threatening to hurt her, to...
Thad swallowed.
To cut her. I'd recognized her voice by then, but the man shouted at her, told her if she didn't identify herself, he'd cut her fucking head off.
Those were his words. Do what I say or I'll cut your fucking head off. Then she said she was Miriam and begged me. He swallowed again. There was a click in his throat, as clear as the letter E sent on a Morse key. She begged me not to let the bad man do that. Cut her again. Across from him, Liz was growing steadily whiter. Don't let her faint, Thad wished or prayed. Please don't let her faint now. She was screaming. Then the line went dead. I think he cut it or pulled it out of the wall. Except that was bullshit. He didn't think anything. He knew. The line had been cut all right. With a straight razor. I tried to get her again, but... What's her address? Pangborn's voice was still crisp, still pleasant, still calm. But for the bright line of urgency and command running through it, he might have simply been batting the breeze with an old friend. It was right to call him, Thad thought. Thank God for people who know what they are doing, or at least believe they do. Thank God for people who behave like characters in pop novels. If I had to deal with a Saul Bellow person here, I believe I would lose my mind. Thad looked below Miriam's name in Liz's book. Honey, is this a 3 or an 8? 8, she said in a distant voice. Good. Sit in the chair again. Put your head in your lap. Mr. Beaumont? Thad? I'm sorry, my wife is very upset. She looks faint. I'm not surprised. You're both upset. It's an upsetting situation, but you're doing well. Just keep it together, Thad. Yes. He realized dismally that if Liz fainted, he would have to leave her lying on the floor and plug along until Pangborn had enough information to make a move. Please don't faint, he thought again, and looked back at Liz's address book. Her address is 109 West 84th Street. Phone number? I tried to tell you, her phone doesn't... I need the number just the same, Thad. Yes, of course you do. Although he didn't have the slightest idea why. I'm sorry. He recited the number. How long ago was this call? Hours, he thought, and looked at the clock over the mantelpiece. His first thought was that it had stopped. Must have stopped. Thad? I'm right here, he said in a calm voice which seemed to be coming from someone else. It was approximately 6 minutes ago. That's when my communication with her ended. It was broken off. Okay, not much time lost. If you'd called NYPD, they might have had you on hold 3 times that long. I'll get back to you as quick as I can, Thad. Rick, he said, tell the police when you talk to them that her ex can't know yet. If the guy's, you know, done something to Miriam, Rick will be next on his list. You're pretty sure this is the same guy who did Homer and Clausen, aren't you? I am positive. And the words were out and flying down the wire before he could be sure he even wanted to say them. I think I know who it is. After the briefest hesitation, Pangborn said, Okay, stay by the phone. I'll want to talk to you about this when there's time. He was gone. Thad looked over at Liz and saw she had slumped sideways in the chair. Her eyes were large and glassy. He got up and went to her quickly, straightened her. Tapped her cheeks lightly. Which one is it? She asked him thickly from the gray world of not quite consciousness. Is it Stark or Alexis Machine? Which one, Thad? And after a very long time, he said, I don't think there's any difference. I'll make tea, Liz. 3. He was sure they would talk about it. How could they avoid it? But they didn't. For a long time, they only sat, looking at each other over the rims of their mugs, and waited for Alan to call back. And as the endless minutes dragged by, it began to seem right to Thad that they not talk, not until Alan called back and told them whether Miriam was dead or alive. Suppose, he thought, watching her bring her mug of tea to her mouth with both hands and sipping at his own, suppose we were sitting here one night, with books in our hands. We'd look to an outsider as if we were reading, and we might be, a little, but what we'd really be doing is savoring the silence as if it were some particularly fine wine, the way only parents of very young children can savor it, because they have so little of it. And further suppose that while we were doing that, a meteorite crashed through the roof and landed, smoking and glowing, on the living room floor. Would one of us go into the kitchen and fill up the floor bucket with water? Douse it before it could light up the carpet, and then just go on reading?
No, we'd talk about it. We'd have to. The way we have to talk about this. Perhaps they would even begin after Alan called back. Perhaps they would even talk through him, Liz listening carefully as Alan asked questions and Thad answered them. Yes, that might be how their own talking would start. Because it seemed to Thad that Alan was the catalyst. In a weird way, it seemed to Thad that Alan was the one who had gotten this thing started, even though the sheriff had only been responding to what Stark had already done. In the meantime, they sat and waited. He felt an urge to try Miriam's number again, but didn't dare. Alan might pick that very moment to call back and would find the Beaumont number busy. He found himself again wishing, in a nameless sort of way, that they had a second line. Well, he thought, wish in one hand, spit in the other. Reason and rationality told him that Stark could not be out there, ramming around like some weird cancer in human form, killing people. As the country rube in Oliver Goldsmith's She Stoops to Conquer was wont to say, it was perfectly impossible, Diggory. He was, though. Thad knew he was, and Liz knew it, too. He wondered if Alan would also know when he told him. You'd think not. You'd expect the guy to simply send for those fine young men in their clean white coats. Because George Stark was not real, and neither was Alexis Machine, that fiction within a fiction. Neither of them had ever existed, any more than George Eliot had ever existed, or Mark Twain, or Lewis Carroll, or Tucker Coe, or Edgar Box. Pseudonyms were only a higher form of fictional character. Yet Thad found it difficult to believe Alan Pangborn would not believe, even if he did not want to at first. Thad himself did not want to, yet found himself helpless to do anything else. It was, if you could pardon the expression, inexorably plausible. Why doesn't he call? Liz asked restlessly. It's only been 5 minutes, babe. Closer to 10. He resisted an urge to snap at her. This wasn't the bonus round in a TV game show. Alan would not be awarded extra points and valuable prizes for calling back before 9 o'clock. There was no Stark, part of his mind continued to insist upon insisting. The voice was rational, but oddly powerless, seeming to repeat this screed not out of any real conviction, but only by rote, like a parrot trained to say, "Pretty boy," or "Polly wants a cracker." Yet it was true, wasn't it? Was he supposed to believe Stark had come back from the grave, like a monster in a horror movie? That would be a neat trick, since the man, or unman, had never been buried, his marker only a papier-mâché headstone set up on the surface of an empty cemetery plot, as fictional as the rest of him. Anyhow, that brings me to the last point, or aspect, or whatever the hell you want to call it. What's your shoe size, Mr. Beaumont? Thad had been slouched in his chair, crazily close to dozing in spite of everything. Now he sat up so suddenly he almost spilled his tea. Footprints. Pangborn had said something about, "What footprints are these?" "Doesn't matter. We don't even have photos. We've got almost everything on the table."
"Thad, what is it?" Liz asked.
"What footprints? Where?" "In Castle Rock, of course, or Alan wouldn't have known about them. Had they perhaps been in Homeland Cemetery, where the neurasthenic lady photographer had shot the picture he and Liz had found so amusing?" "Not a very nice guy," he muttered.
"Thad?"
Then the phone rang, and both of them spilled their tea. 4. Thad's hand dived for the receiver, then paused for a moment, floating just above it. "What if it's him?" "I'm not done with you, Thad. You don't want to fuck with me because when you fuck with me, you're fucking with the best." He made his hand go down, close around the telephone, and bring it to his ear. "Hello?" "Thad?" It was Alan Pangborn's voice. Suddenly, Thad felt very limp, as if his body had been held together with stiff little wires which had just been removed. "Yes," he said. The word came out sibilant in a kind of sigh. He drew in another breath. "Is Miriam all right?" "I don't know," Alan said. "I've given the NYPD her address. We should hear quite soon, although I want to caution you that 15 minutes or half an hour may not seem like a quite soon to you and your wife this evening." "No, it won't," Is she all right? Liz was asking, and Thad covered the phone mouthpiece long enough to tell her that Pangborn didn't know yet. Liz nodded and settled back, still too white, but seeming calmer and more in control than before. At least people were doing things now, and it wasn't solely their responsibility anymore. They also got Mr. Cowley's address from the telephone company. Hey, they won't, Thad. They won't do anything until they know what the Cowley woman's condition is. I told them we had a situation where a mentally unbalanced man might be after a person or persons named in the People magazine article about the Stark pen name, and explained the connection the Cowleys had to you. I hope I got it right. I don't know much about writers and even less about their agents, but they do understand it would be wrong for the lady's ex-husband to go rushing over there before they arrive. Thank you. Thank you for everything, Alan. Thad, NYPD is too busy moving on this to want or need further explanations right now. But they will want them. I do, too. Who do you think this guy is? That's something I don't want to tell you over the telephone. I'd come to you, Alan, but I don't want to leave my wife and children right now. I think you can understand. You'll have to come here. I can't do that, Alan said patiently. I have a job of my own, and... Is your wife ill, Alan? Tonight she seems quite well, but one of my deputies called in sick and I've got to sub for him. Standard procedure in small towns. I was just getting ready to leave. What I'm saying is that this is a very bad time for you to be coy, Thad. Tell me. He thought about it. He'd felt strangely confident that Pangborn would buy it when he heard it. But maybe not over the telephone. Could you get up here tomorrow? We'll have to get together tomorrow, certainly, Alan said. His voice was both even and utterly insistent. But I need whatever you know tonight. The fact that the Fuzz in New York are going to want an explanation is secondary as far as I'm concerned. I have my own garden to tend. There are a lot of people here in town who want Homer Gamache's murderer collared, pronto. I happen to be one of them. So don't make me ask you again. It's not so late that I can't get the Penobscot County DA on the phone and ask him to collar you as a material witness in a Castle County murder case. He knows already from the state police that you're a suspect, alibi or no alibi. Would you do that? Thad asked, bemused and fascinated. I would if you made me, but I don't think you will. Thad's head seemed clearer now. His thoughts actually seemed to be going somewhere. It wouldn't really matter, either to Pangborn or to the NYPD, if the man they were looking for was a psycho who thought he was Stark, or Stark himself. Would it? He didn't think so, any more than he thought they were going to catch him either way. I'm pretty sure it's a psychotic, as my wife said, he told Alan finally. He locked eyes with Liz, tried to send her a message, and he must have succeeded in sending her something because she nodded slightly. It makes a weird kind of sense. Do you remember mentioning footprints to me?
Yes.
They were in Homeland, weren't they? Across the room, Liz's eyes widened. How did you know that? Alan sounded off balance for the first time. I didn't tell you that. Have you read the article yet, the one in People?
Yes.
That's where the woman set up the fake tombstone. That's where George Stark was buried. Silence from the other end. Then, oh shit. You get it?
I think so, Alan said.
If this guy thinks he's Stark, and if he's crazy, the idea of him starting at Stark's grave makes a certain kind of sense, doesn't it? Is this photographer in New York?
Thad started.
Yes.
Then she might also be in danger?
Yes, I... Well, I never thought of that, but I suppose she might.
Name? Address?
I don't have her address.
She had given him her business card, he remembered, probably thinking about the book on which she hoped he would collaborate with her, but he had thrown it away. Shit. All he could give Alan was the name.
Phyllis Myers.
And the guy who actually wrote the story?
Mike Donaldson.
Also in New York?
Thad suddenly realized he didn't know that, not for sure, and backtracked a little.
Well, I guess I just assumed both of them were... It's a reasonable enough assumption. If the magazine's offices are in New York, they'd stick close, wouldn't they?
Maybe, but if one or both of them is freelance, let's go back to this trick photo. The cemetery wasn't specifically identified, either in the photo caption or in the body of the story, as homeland. I'm sure of that. I should have recognized it from the background, but I was concentrating on the details. No, Thad said. I guess it wasn't. The first selectman, Dan Keaton, would have insisted that homeland not be identified. That would have been a brass-bound condition. He's a very cautious type of guy. Sort of a pill, actually. I can see him giving permission to do the photos, but I think he would have nixed an ID of the specific cemetery in case of vandalism. People looking for the headstone and all of that. Thad was nodding. It made sense. So your psycho either knows you or comes from here, Alan was going on. Thad had made an assumption of which he was now heartily ashamed. That the sheriff of a small Maine county where there were no more trees than people must be a jerk. This was no jerk. He was certainly running rings around that world champion novelist Thaddeus Beaumont. We have to assume that, at least for the time being, since it seems he had inside information. Then the tracks you mentioned were in Homeland. Sure they were, Pangborn said almost absently. What are you holding back, Thad? What do you mean? He asked warily. Let's not dance, okay? I've got to call New York with these other two names, and you've got to put on your thinking cap and see if there are any more names I should have. Publishers, editors, I don't know. Meantime, you tell me the guy we want actually thinks he is George Stark. We were theorizing about it Saturday night, blue-skying it, and tonight you tell me it's a stone fact. Then, to back it up, you throw the footprints at me. Either you've made some dizzying leap of deduction based on the facts we have in common, or you know something I don't. Naturally, I like the second alternative better. So give. But what did he have? Blackout trances which were announced by thousands of sparrows crying in unison? Words that he might have written on a manuscript after Alan Pangborn had told him those same words were written on the living room wall of Frederick Clausen's apartment? More words written on a paper which had been torn to shreds and then fed into the English math building's incinerator? Dreams in which a terrible unseen man led him through his house in Castle Rock, and everything he touched, including his own wife, self-destructed? I could call what I believe a known fact of the heart instead of an intuition of the mind, he thought, but there's still no proof, is there? The fingerprints and saliva suggested something was very odd. Sure. But that odd? Thad didn't think so. Alan, he said slowly, you'd laugh. No, I take it back. I know you better than that now. You wouldn't laugh. But I strongly doubt if you would believe me either. I've been up and down on this, but that's how it shakes out. I really don't think you'd believe me. Alan's voice came back at once, urgent, imperative, hard to resist. Try me. Thad hesitated, looked at Liz, then shook his head. Tomorrow, when we can look at each other face to face, then I will. For tonight, you'll just have to take my word that it doesn't matter, that what I've told you is everything of any practical value that I can tell you. Thad, what I said about having you held as a material witness, if you have to do it, do it. There will be no hard feelings on my part, but I won't go any further than I have right now until I see you, regardless of what you decide. Silence from Pangborn's end. Then a sigh. Okay. I want to give you a scratch description of the man the police are looking for. I'm not entirely sure it's right, but I think it's close. Close enough to give the cops in New York, anyway. Have you got a pencil? Yes, give it to me. Thad closed the eyes God had put in his face and opened the one God had put in his mind, the eye which persisted in seeing even the things he didn't want to look at. When people who had read his books met him for the first time, they were invariably disappointed. This was something they tried to hide from him and could not. He bore them no grudge because he understood how they felt, at least a little bit. If they liked his work, and some professed even to love it, they thought of him beforehand as a guy who was first cousin to God. Instead of a god, they saw a guy who stood 6'1", wore spectacles, was beginning to lose his hair, and had a habit of tripping over things. They saw a man whose scalp was rather flaky and whose nose had two holes in it, just like their own. What they could not see was that third eye inside his head. That eye, glowing in the dark half of him,
the side which was in constant shade. That was like a god, but he was glad they could not see it. If they could, he thought many of them would try to steal it. Yes, even if it meant gouging it right out of his flesh with a dull knife. Looking into the dark, he summoned up his private image of George Stark, the real George Stark, who looked nothing like the model who had posed for the jacket photo. He looked for the Shadow Man, who had accreted soundlessly over the years, found him, and began showing him to Alan Pangborn. "He's fairly tall," he began. "Taller than me, anyway. 6'3", maybe 6'4", in a pair of boots. He's got blonde hair, cut short and neat. Blue eyes. His long vision is excellent. About 5 years ago, he took to wearing glasses for close work, reading and writing mostly. The reason he gets noticed isn't his height, but his breadth. He's not fat, but he's extremely wide. Neck size, maybe 18 and a half, maybe 19. He's my age, Alan, but he's not fading the way I'm starting to or running to fat. He's strong, like Schwarzenegger looks now that Schwarzenegger has started to build down a little. He works out with weights. He can pump a bicep hard enough to pop a sleeve seam on his shirt, but he's not muscle-bound. He was born in New Hampshire, but following the divorce of his parents, he moved with his mother to Oxford, Mississippi, where she was raised. He's lived most of his life there. When he was younger, he had an accent so thick he sounded like he came from Dogpatch. A lot of people made fun of that accent in college. Not to his face, though. You don't make fun of a guy like this to his face. And he worked hard on getting rid of it. Now I think the only time you'd be apt to hear cracker in his voice would be when he gets mad. And I think people who make him mad are often not available for testimony later on. He's got a short fuse. He's violent. He's dangerous. He is, in fact, a practicing psychotic. "What?" Pangborn began, but Thad overrode him. "He's quite deeply tanned, and since blonde men usually don't tan all that well, it might be a good point of identification. Big feet, big hands, big neck, wide shoulders. His face looks like somebody talented but in a hurry chopped it out of a hard rock. Final thing, he may be driving a black Toronado. I don't know what year. One of the old ones that had a lot of blasting powder under the hood, anyway. Black. It could have Mississippi plates, but he's probably switched them." He paused, then added, "Oh, and there's a sticker on the back bumper. It says, 'High-toned son of a bitch.'" He opened his eyes. Liz was staring at him. Her face was paler than ever. There was a long pause on the other end of the line. "Alan, are you—" "Just a sec. I'm writing." There was another shorter pause. "Okay," he said at last. "I got it. You can tell me all of this, but not who the guy is or your connection with him or how you know him." "I don't know, but I'll try. Tomorrow. Knowing his name isn't going to help anyone tonight anyway, because he's using another one. George Stark. Well, he could be crazy enough to be calling himself Alexis Machine, but I doubt it. Stark is what I think, yeah." He tried to wink at Liz. He did not really believe the mood could be lightened by a wink or anything else, but he tried anyway. He only succeeded in blinking both eyes like a sleepy owl. "There's no way I can persuade you to go on with this tonight, is there?" "No, there's not. I'm sorry, but there's not." "All right. I'll get back to you as soon as I can." And he was gone, just like that. No thank you, no goodbye. Thinking it over, Thad supposed he didn't really rate a thank you. He hung up the phone and went to his wife, who sat looking at him as if she had been turned into a statue. He took her hands, they were very cold, and said, "This is going to be all right, Liz. I swear it is." "Are you going to tell him about the trances when you talk to him tomorrow? The sound of the birds? How you heard it when you were a kid and what it meant then? The things you wrote?" "I'm going to tell him everything," Thad said. "What he chooses to pass on to the other authorities," he shrugged. "That's up to him." "So much," she said in a strengthless little voice. Her eyes were still fixed on him, seemed powerless to leave him. "You know so much about him. Thad, how?" He could only kneel there before her, holding her cold hands. How could he know so much? People asked him that all the time.
They used different words to express it. How did you make that up? How did you put that into words? How did you remember that? How did you see that? But it always came back to the same thing. How did you know that? He didn't know how he knew. He just did. So much, she repeated, and she spoke in the tone of a sleeper who is in the grip of a distressful dream. Then they were both silent. He kept expecting the twins to sense their parents' upset, to wake up and begin crying, but there was only the steady tick of the clock. He shifted to a more comfortable position on the floor by her chair and went on holding her hands, hoping he could warm them up. They were still cold 15 minutes later when the phone rang. 5. Alan Pangborn was flat and declarative. Rick Cowley was safe in his apartment and was under police protection. He would soon be on his way to his ex-wife, who would now be his ex-wife forever, the reconciliation of which both had spoken from time to time, and with considerable longing, was never going to happen. Miriam was dead. Rick would make the formal identification at the Borough of Manhattan morgue on First Avenue. Thad should not expect a call from Rick tonight or attempt to make one himself. Thad's connection with Miriam Cowley's murder had been withheld from Rick, pending developments. Phyllis Myers had been located and was also under police protection. Michael Donaldson was proving a tougher nut, but they expected to have him located and covered by midnight. How was she killed? Thad asked, knowing the answer perfectly well. But sometimes you had to ask. God knew why. Throat was cut, Alan said, with what Thad suspected was intentional brutality. He followed it up a moment later. Still sure there's nothing you want to tell me? In the morning, when we can look at each other. Okay, I didn't think there was any harm in asking. Nope, no harm. The New York City police have an APB out on a man named George Stark. Your description. Good. And he supposed it was, although he knew it was also probably pointless. They almost certainly wouldn't find him if he didn't want to be found, and if anyone did, Thad thought that person would be sorry. 9 o'clock, Pangborn said. Make sure you're at home, Thad. Count on it. 6. Liz took a tranquilizer and finally fell asleep. Thad drifted in and out of a thin, scratchy doze and got up at 3:15 to use the bathroom. As he was standing there, urinating into the bowl, he thought he heard the sparrows. He tensed, listening, the flow of his water drying up at once. The sound neither grew nor diminished, and after a few moments he realized it was only crickets. He looked out the window and saw a state police cruiser parked across the road, dark and silent. He might have thought it was also deserted if he hadn't seen the fitful wink of a cigarette ember. It seemed that he, Liz, and the twins were also under police protection. Or police guard, he thought, and went back to bed. Whichever it was, it seemed to provide a little peace of mind. He fell asleep and woke at 8, with no memory of bad dreams. But of course, the real bad dream was still out there. Somewhere. Chapter 14. Fool's Stuffing. 1. The guy with the stupid little pussy-tickler mustache was a lot quicker than Stark had expected. Stark had been waiting for Michael Donaldson in the 9th-floor hallway of the building where Donaldson lived, just around the corner from Donaldson's apartment door. It all would have been easier if Stark could have gotten into the apartment first, as he had done with the bitch, but a single glance was enough to convince him that these locks, unlike hers, had not been put in by Jiminy Cricket. It should have been all right just the same. It was late, and all the rabbits in the warren should have been fast asleep and dreaming of clover. Donaldson himself should have been slow and fuddled. When he came home at 1:15 in the morning, it wasn't from the public library. Donaldson did seem a trifle fuddled, but he was not slow at all. When Stark stepped around the corner and slashed out with the razor as Donaldson fiddled and diddled with his keyring, he expected to blind the man quickly and efficiently. Then, before he could more than begin a cry, he would open Donaldson's throat, cutting his plumbing at the same time he severed his vocal cords. Stark did not try to move quietly. He wanted Donaldson to hear him, wanted Donaldson to turn his face toward him. It would make it easier. Donaldson did what he was supposed to at first. Stark whipped the razor at his face in a short, hard arc. But Donaldson managed to duck a little. Not much, but too much for Stark's purposes. Instead of getting his eyes, the straight razor laid his forehead open to the bone. A flap of skin curled down over Donaldson's eyebrows like a loose strip of wallpaper.
"Help!"
Donaldson blatted in a strangled, sheep-like voice. And there went your no-hitter. Fuck. Stark moved in, holding the straight razor out in front of his own eyes with the blade slightly turned up, like a matador saluting the bull before the first corrida. Okay, it didn't go just according to Hoyle every time. He hadn't blinded the stool pigeon, but blood was pouring out of the cut on his forehead in what looked like pints, and what little Donaldson was seeing would be coming through a sticky red haze. He slashed at Donaldson's throat, and the bastard pulled his head back almost as fast as a rattlesnake recoiling from a strike. Amazing speed. And Stark found himself admiring the man a little, ridiculous pussy-tickler mustache or not. The blade cut only air a quarter of an inch from the man's throat, and he screamed for help again. The rabbits, who never slept deeply in this city, this maggoty old Big Apple, would be waking up. Stark reversed direction and brought the blade back again, at the same time rising on his toes and thrusting his body forward. It was a graceful, balletic movement, and should have finished it. But Donaldson somehow managed to get a hand up in front of his throat. Instead of killing him, Stark only administered a series of long, shallow wounds which police pathologists would call defense cuts. Donaldson raised his hand, palm out, and the razor passed across the base of all four fingers. He wore a heavy class ring on the third, and so that one sustained no wound. There was a crisp and minute metallic sound, brink, as the blade ran across it, leaving a tiny scar in the gold alloy. The razor cut the other three fingers deeply, sliding as effortlessly into the flesh as a warm knife slides into butter. Tendons cut, the fingers slumped forward like sleepy puppets, leaving only the ring finger standing upright, as if in his confusion and horror Donaldson had forgotten which finger you used when you wanted to flip somebody the bird. This time, when Donaldson opened his mouth, he actually howled, and Stark knew he could forget about getting out of this one unheard and unnoticed. He'd had every expectation of doing just that, since he didn't have to save Donaldson long enough to make any telephone calls, but it just wasn't happening. But neither did he intend to let Donaldson live. Once you'd started the wet work, you didn't quit until either it was done or you were. Stark bored in. They had moved down the corridor almost to the next apartment door by now. He flicked the straight razor casually sideways to clear the blade. A fine spray of droplets splashed the cream-colored wall. Farther down the hall, a door opened, and a man in a blue pajama shirt with his hair in sleep corkscrews poked his head and shoulders out. "What's going on?" he cried in a gruff voice which proclaimed that he didn't care if it was the Pope of Rome out here, the party was over. "Murder," Stark said conversationally, and for just a moment his eyes shifted from the bloody, howling man in front of him to the man in the doorway. Later this man would tell the police that the intruder's eyes were blue, bright blue, and utterly mad. "Do you want some?" The door shut so fast it might never have been opened at all. Panicked though he must be, hurt though he undoubtedly was, Donaldson saw an opportunity when Stark's gaze shifted, even though the diversion was only momentary. He took it. The little bastard really was quick. Stark's admiration grew. The mark's speed and sense of self-preservation were almost enough to outweigh the fucking nuisance he was making of himself. Had he leaped forward, grappled with Stark, he might have graduated from the nuisance stage to something approaching a real problem. Instead, Donaldson turned to run. Perfectly understandable, but a mistake. Stark ran after him, big shoes whispering on the carpet, and slashed at the back of the man's neck, confident that this would finally finish it. But in the instant of time before the straight razor should have slashed home, Donaldson simultaneously jerked his head forward and somehow tucked it like a turtle pulling into its shell. Stark was beginning to think Donaldson was telepathic. This time, what was meant to be the killing strike merely split the scalp above the protective bulge of bone at the back of the neck. It was bloody, but far from fatal. This was irritating, maddening, and edging into the land of the ludicrous. Donaldson lurched down the corridor, veering from one side to the other, sometimes even banging off the walls like a pinball striking one of those lighted posts that score the player 100,000 points,
or a free game or some fucking thing. He screamed as he lurched down the hall. He poured blood on the carpet as he lurched down the hall. He left the occasional gory handprint to mark his progress as he lurched down the hall. But he was not yet dying as he lurched down the hall. No other doors opened, but Stark knew that right now, in at least half a dozen apartments, half a dozen fingers were punching, or had already punched, 911 on half a dozen phones. Donaldson lurched and stumbled onward toward the elevators. Not angry or frightened, only terribly exasperated, Stark strode after him. Suddenly he thundered, "Oh, why don't you just stop and behave?" Donaldson's current cry for help turned into a shocked squeak. He tried to look around. His feet tangled in each other, and he fell sprawling 10 feet from where the hallway opened into the small elevator lobby. Even the most nimble of fellows, Stark had found, eventually ran out of happy thoughts if you cut them enough. Donaldson got to his knees. He apparently meant to crawl to the elevator lobby now that his feet had betrayed him. He looked around with his bloody no face to see where his attacker was, and Stark launched a kick at the red-drenched ridge of his nose. He was wearing brown loafers, and he kicked the goddamn pest as hard as he could, hands down at his sides and thrust slightly backward to maintain balance, left foot connecting and then rising in an arc as high as his own forehead. Anyone who had ever seen a football game would have inevitably been reminded of a very good, very strong punt. Donaldson's head flew backward, smashed into the wall hard enough to cave the plaster into a shallow bowl shape at that point, and rebounded. "Finally pulled your batteries, didn't I?" Stark murmured, and heard a door open behind him. He turned and saw a woman with tousled black hair and huge dark eyes looking out of an apartment door almost all the way down the hall. "Get back in there, bitch!" he screamed. The door slammed as if it were on a spring. He bent, grabbed Donaldson's tacky, gruesome hair, twisted his head back, and cut his throat. He thought Donaldson had probably been dead even before his head connected with the wall, and almost certainly after, but it was best to be sure. And besides, when you started cutting, you finished cutting. He stepped back quickly, but Donaldson did not spurt as the woman had. His pump had already quit or was wheezing to a stop. Stark walked rapidly toward the elevators, folding the straight razor and sliding it back into his pocket. An arriving elevator binged softly. It might have been a tenant. Going on one wasn't really late in the big city, even for a Monday night. All the same, Stark moved rapidly for the large potted plant which occupied the corner of the elevator lobby along with an absolutely useless non-representational painting. He stepped behind the plant. All his radar was pinging loudly. It could be someone returning from a post-weekend bout of disco fever or the bibulous aftermath of a business dinner, but he didn't believe it would be either. He believed it would be the police. In fact, he knew it. A cruiser, which fortuitously happened to be in the vicinity of the building when one of the residents of this wing telephoned to say that a murder was being committed in the hallway? Possible, but Stark doubted it. It seemed more likely that Beaumont had raised the roof. Sissy had been discovered. And this was Donaldson's police protection arriving. Better belated than never. He slid slowly down the wall with his back against it, the blood-stained sport coat he was wearing making a husky whispering noise. He did not so much hide as submerge like a submarine going to periscope depth, and the concealment the potted plant offered was at best minimal. If they looked around, they would see him. Stark, however, was betting all their attention would be riveted by Exhibit A there halfway down the hall, for a few moments anyway, and that would be enough. The plant's broad, crisscrossing leaves printed sawtoothed shadows on his face. Stark stared out from between them like a blue-eyed tiger. The elevator doors opened. There was a muffled exclamation, "Holy something or other," and two uniformed cops rushed out. They were followed by a black guy in a pair of pegged jeans and big old diddy-bop sneakers with Velcro closures. The black guy also wore a T-shirt with cut-off sleeves. "Property of the New York Yankees" was printed on the front. He also wore a pair of wraparound pimp shades, and if he wasn't a detective, Stark was George of the motherfucking jungle. When they went undercover, they always went too far, and then acted self-conscious about it. It was as if they knew they were going overboard, but simply couldn't help it. This was, or had been meant to be anyhow, Donaldson's protection then. There wouldn't have been a detective in a passing squad car. This was just a little too fortuitous. This guy had come along with the door guards to first question Donaldson and then babysit him. Sorry, fellows, Stark thought. I think this baby's talking days are over. He pushed to his feet and walked around the potted plant. Not a single leaf whispered. His feet were soundless on the carpet. He passed less than 3 feet behind the detective, who was bent over, pulling a .32 from a shin holster. Stark could have booted him a damned good one in the ass if he'd cared to. He slipped into the open elevator car in the last whisker of time before the door began to slide closed. One of the uniformed cops had caught a flicker of movement, perhaps the door, perhaps Stark himself, and it didn't really matter, out of the corner of his eye, and raised his head from Donaldson's body. Hey! Stark raised one hand and solemnly twiddled his fingers at the cop. Bye-bye. Then the door cut off the hallway tableau. The street-level lobby was deserted, except for the doorman who lay comatose beneath his desk. Stark went out, turned the corner, got into a stolen car, and drove away. 2. Phyllis Myers lived in one of the new apartment buildings on the west side of Manhattan. Her police protection, accompanied by a detective wearing Nike running pants, a New York Islanders sweatshirt with ripped-off sleeves, and wraparound pimp shades, had arrived at 10:30 on the evening of June 6th to find her fuming over a broken date. She was surly at first, but cheered up considerably when she heard that someone who thought he was George Stark might be interested in murdering her. She answered the detective's questions about the Thad Beaumont interview, which she referred to as the Thad Beaumont shoot, while loading 3 cameras with fresh film and fiddling with some 2 dozen lenses. When the detective asked her what she was doing, she gave him a wink and said, "I believe in the Boy Scout motto. Who knows? Something might really happen." After the interview, outside her apartment door, one of the uniforms asked the detective, "Is she for real?" "Sure," the detective said. "Her problem is that she doesn't really think anything else is. To her, the whole world's just a photograph waiting to happen. What she got in there is a silly bitch who really believes she's always going to be on the right side of the lens." Now, at 3:30 on the morning of June 7th, the detective was long gone. 2 hours or so before, the 2 men assigned to protect Phyllis Myers had gotten the news of Donaldson's murder on the police radios clipped to their belts. They were advised to be extremely cautious and extremely vigilant, as the psycho they were dealing with had proved to be both extremely bloodthirsty and extremely quick-witted. "Cautious is my middle name," said Cop Number 1. "That's a coincidence," said Cop Number 2. "Extremely is mine." They had been partners for over a year, and they got on well. Now they grinned at each other. And why not? They were 2 armed, uniformed members of the maggoty old Big Apple's finest, standing in a well-lit air-conditioned hallway on the 26th floor of a brand-new apartment building. Or maybe it was a condo, who the fuck knew? When officers cautious and extremely were boys, a condo was something a guy with a speech impediment wore on the end of his dingus. And no one was going to creep up on them or jump out of the ceiling on top of them or hose them down with a magic Uzi that never jammed or ran out of ammunition. This was real life, not an 87th Precinct novel or a Rambo movie. And what real life consisted of tonight was a little special duty, one hell of a lot softer than riding around in a cruiser, stopping fights in bars until the bars closed, and then stopping them until the dawn's early light, in shitty little walk-ups where drunk husbands and wives had agreed to disagree. Real life should always consist of being cautious and extremely in air-conditioned hallways on hot nights in the city, or so they firmly believed. They had progressed this far in their thinking when the elevator door opened and the wounded blind man staggered out of the car and into the corridor. He was tall, with very broad shoulders. He looked about 40. He was wearing a torn sport coat and pants which did not match the coat but at least complemented it. More or less, anyway. The first cop, cautious, had time to think that the sighted person who picked the blind man's clothes must have pretty good taste. The blind man was also wearing big black glasses that were askew on his nose because one of the bows had been snapped clean off. They were not, by any stretch of the imagination, wraparound pimp shades. What they looked like were the sunglasses Claude Rains had worn in The Invisible Man. The blind man was holding both hands out in front of him. The left was empty, just waving aimlessly.
In the right, he clutched a dirty white cane with a rubber bicycle hand grip on the end. Both hands were covered with drying blood. There were maroon smears of blood drying on the blind man's sport coat and shirt. If the two cops assigned to guard Phyllis Myers had actually been extremely cautious, the whole thing might have struck them as odd. The blind man was hollering about something which had apparently just happened, and from the look of him, something sure had happened to him, and not a very nice thing either. But the blood on his skin and clothes had already turned brownish. This suggested it had been spilled some time ago, a fact which might have struck officers deeply committed to the concept of extreme caution as a trifle offbeat. It might even have hoisted a red flag in the minds of such officers. Probably not, though. Things just happened too fast, and when things happen fast enough, it stops mattering if you are extremely cautious or extremely reckless. You just have to go with the flow. At one moment, they were standing outside the Myers woman's door, happy as kids on a day when school is canceled because the boiler went kaflooey. At the next, this bloody blind man was in their faces, waving his dirty white cane. There was no time to think, let alone deduce.
"Police!"
the blind man was yelling, even before the elevator doors were all the way open.
"Doorman says the police are on 26. Police! Are you here?"
Now he was wallowing his way down the hall, cane swinging from side to side, and whack, it hit the wall on his left, and swish, back it went, and whack, the wall on his right, and anyone on the goddamn floor who wasn't awake already would be soon. Extremely incautious, both started forward without so much as exchanging a glance.
"Police!
"Sir," Extremely barked, "hold it! You're gonna fall down—" The blind man jerked his head in the direction of Extremely's voice, but did not stop. He plunged onward, waving his empty hand and his dirty white cane, looking a bit like Leonard Bernstein trying to conduct the New York Philharmonic after smoking a vial or two of crack.
"Police! They killed my dog! They killed Daisy! Police!"
"Sir!" Cautious reached for the reeling blind man. The reeling blind man put his empty hand in the left pocket of his sport coat and came out not with two tickets to the blind man's gala ball, but a .45 revolver. He pointed it at Cautious and pulled the trigger twice. The reports were deafening and toneless in the close hallway. There was a lot of blue smoke. Cautious took the bullets at nearly point-blank range. He went down with his chest caved in like a broken peach basket. His tunic was scorched and smoldering. Extremely stared as the blind man pointed the .45 at him.
"Jesus, please don't,"
Extremely said in a very tiny voice. He sounded as if someone had knocked the wind out of him. The blind man fired two more times. There was more blue smoke. He shot very well for a blind man. Extremely flew backward, away from the blue smoke, hit the hall carpet on his shoulder blades, went through a sudden shuddery spasm, and lay still. 3. In Ludlow, 500 miles away, Thad Beaumont turned over restlessly on his side.
"Blue smoke," he muttered. "Blue smoke."
Outside the bedroom window, 9 sparrows sat on a telephone line. They were joined by half a dozen more. The birds sat, silent and unseen, above the watchers in the state police car.
"I won't need these anymore," Thad said in his sleep.
He made a clumsy pawing motion at his face with one hand and a tossing gesture with the other.
"Thad?"
Liz asked, sitting up.
"Thad, are you okay?"
Thad said something incomprehensible in his sleep. Liz looked down at her arms. They were thick with goosebumps.
"Thad, is it the birds again? Do you hear the birds?"
Thad said nothing. Outside the windows, the sparrows took wing in unison and flew off into the dark, although this was not their time to fly. Neither Liz nor the two policemen in the state police cruiser noticed them. 4. Stark tossed the dark glasses and the cane aside. The hallway was acrid with cordite smoke. He had fired 4 Colt high-point loads, which he had dum-dummed. 2 of them had passed through the cops and had left plate-sized holes in the corridor wall. He walked over to Phyllis Myers's door. He was ready to talk her out if he had to, but she was right there on the other side, and he could tell just listening to her that she would be easy.
"What's going on?" she screamed. "What happened?"
"We've got him, Ms. Myers," Stark said cheerfully. "If you want the picture, get it goddamn fast, and just remember later I never said you could take one." She kept the door on the chain when she opened it, but that was okay. When she placed one wide brown eye to the crack, he put a bullet through it. Closing her eyes, or closing the one eye still in existence, was not an option, so he turned and started back toward the elevators. He did not linger, but he did not run either. One apartment door eased open. Everyone was opening doors on him tonight, it seemed, and Stark raised the gun at the starry-eyed rabbit face he saw. The door slammed at once. He pushed the elevator button. The door of the car he'd ridden up in after knocking out his second doorman of the evening, with the cane he had stolen from the blind man on 60th Street, opened at once, as he had expected it would. At this hour of the night, the three elevators were not exactly in great demand. He tossed the gun back over his shoulder. It thumped onto the carpet. "That went all right," he remarked, got into the elevator car, and rode down to the lobby. 5. The sun was coming up in Rick Cowley's living room window when the telephone rang. Rick was 50, red-eyed, haggard, half-drunk. He picked up the telephone with a hand that shook badly. He hardly knew where he was, and his tired, aching mind kept insisting all this was a dream. Had he been, less than 3 hours ago, down at the Borough Morgue on First Avenue, identifying his ex-wife's mutilated corpse less than a block from the chic little French restaurant where they took only the clients who were also friends? Were there police outside his door, because the man who had killed Mir might also want to kill him? Were these things true? Surely not. It surely had to be a dream. And maybe the phone wasn't really the phone at all, but the bedside alarm. As a rule, he hated that fucking thing, had thrown it across the room on more than one occasion. But this morning he would kiss it. Hell, he would French kiss it. But he didn't wake up. Instead, he answered the telephone. "Hello?" "This is the man who cut your woman's throat," the voice in his ear said, and Rick was suddenly wide awake. Any lingering hope he'd had that this was all just a dream dissipated. It was the sort of voice you should only hear in dreams, but that is never where you hear it. "Who are you?" he heard himself asking in a strengthless little voice. "Ask Thad Beaumont who I am," the man said. "He knows all about it. Tell him I said you're walking around dead, and tell him I'm not done making fool's stuffing yet." The phone clicked in his ear. There was a moment of silence, and then the vapid hum of an open line. Rick lowered the telephone into his lap, looked at it, and suddenly burst into tears. 6. At 9 that morning, Rick called the office and told Frieda that she and John should go home. They would not be working today. Not for the rest of the week. Frieda wanted to know why, and Rick was astounded to find himself on the verge of lying to her, as if he had been busted for some nasty and serious crime, child molestation, say, and couldn't bring himself to admit it until the shock was a little less acute.
"Miriam is dead," he told Frieda. "She was killed in her apartment last night."
Frieda drew in her breath in a quick, shocked hiss.
"Jesus, God, Rick, don't joke about things like that. You joke about things like that, they come true."
"It is true, Frieda," he said,
and found he was on the edge of tears again. And these, the ones he'd shed at the morgue, the ones he'd shed in the car coming back here, the ones he'd shed when that crazy man called, the ones he was trying not to shed now, these were only the first. Thinking of all the tears in his future made him feel intensely weary. Miriam had been a bitch, but she had also been, in her own way, a sweet bitch, and he had loved her. Rick closed his eyes. When he opened them, there was a man looking in at him through the window, even though the window was 14 stories up. Rick started, then saw the uniform, a window cleaner. The window cleaner waved to him from his scaffold. Rick lifted a hand in a token return salute. His hand seemed to weigh somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 pounds. And he let it fall back onto his thigh almost as soon as he had raised it.
Frida was telling him again not to joke, and he felt more weary than ever. Tears, he saw, were only the beginning. He said, "Just a minute, Frida," and put the phone down. He went to the window to draw the drapes. Crying over the telephone with Frida at the other end was bad enough. He didn't have to have the goddamn window cleaner watch him do it. As he reached the window, the man on the scaffold reached into the slash pocket of his coverall to get something. Rick felt a sudden twinge of unease. "Tell him I said you're walking around dead."
"Jesus."
The window cleaner brought out a small sign. It was yellow with black letters. The message was flanked with moronic smiley smile faces. "Have a nice day," it read. Rick nodded wearily. "Have a nice day. Sure." He drew the drapes and went back to the phone. 7. When he finally convinced Frida he wasn't joking, she burst into loud and utterly genuine sobs. Everyone at the office and all the clients, even that goddamn Putz Olinger, who wrote the bad science fiction novels and who had apparently dedicated himself to the task of snapping every bra in the Western world, had liked Mir. And sure enough, Rick cried with her until he finally managed to disengage himself. "At least," he thought, "I closed the drapes." 15 minutes later, while he was making coffee, the crazy man's call jumped into his head again. There were 2 cops outside his door, and he hadn't told them a thing. What in the hell was wrong with him? "Well," he thought, "my ex-wife died, and when I saw her at the morgue, it looked like she'd grown an extra mouth 2 inches below her chin. That might have something to do with it." "Ask Thad Beaumont who I am. He knows all about it." He had meant to call Thad, of course, but his mind was still in freefall. Things had assumed new proportions, which he did not, at least as yet, seem capable of grasping. Well, he would call Thad. He would do it just as soon as he told the police about the call. He did tell them, and they were extremely interested. One of them got on his walkie-talkie to police headquarters with the information. When he finished, he told Rick that the chief of detectives wanted him to come down to 1 police plaza and talk to them about the call he had received. While he did that, a fellow would pop into his apartment and fit his telephone with a tape recorder and traceback equipment, in case there were any more calls. "There probably will be," the second cop told Rick. "These psychos are really in love with the sound of their own voices." "I ought to call Thad first," Rick said. "He may be in trouble too. That's the way it sounded." "Mr. Beaumont has already been placed under police protection up in Maine, Mr. Cowley. Let's go, shall we?" "Well, I really think perhaps you can call him from the big one. Now, do you have a coat?" So Rick, confused and not at all sure any of this was real, allowed himself to be led away. 8. When they got back 2 hours later, one of Rick's escorts frowned at his apartment door and said, "There's no one here." "So what?" Rick asked wanly. He felt wan, like a pane of milky glass you could almost see through. He had been asked a great many questions and had answered them as well as he could, a difficult task since so few of them seemed to make any sense. "If the guys from communications finished before we got back, they were supposed to wait." "They're probably inside," Rick said. "One of them, maybe, but the other one should be out here. It's standard procedure." Rick took out his keys, shuffled through them, found the right one, and slipped it into the lock. Any problems these fellows might be having with the operating procedure of their colleagues was no concern of his. Thank God, he had all the concerns he could manage this morning. "I ought to call Thad first thing," he said. He sighed and smiled a little. "It isn't even noon, and I already feel like the day is never going to end." "Don't do that!" one of the cops shouted suddenly and sprang forward. "Do what?" Rick began, turning his key, and the door exploded in a flash of light and smoke and sound. The cop whose instincts had triggered just an instant too late was recognizable to his relatives. Rick Cowley was nearly vaporized. The other cop, who had been standing a little farther back and who had instinctively shielded his face when his partner cried out, was treated for burns, concussion, and internal injuries. Mercifully, almost magically, the shrapnel from the door and the wall flew around him in a cloud but never touched him. He would never work for the NYPD again, however. The blast struck him stone deaf in an instant.
Inside Rick's apartment, the two technicians from communications who had come to cook the phones lay dead on the living room rug. Tacked to the forehead of one with a pushpin was this note: "The sparrows are flying again." Tacked to the forehead of the other was a second message: "More fool's stuffing. Tell Thad."